Hello and welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 387. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me, as always, are John Lindemann.
England is terrible at football.
Yes, and James Jones.
At football or just in general?
At American football, they're really bad.
I'll stick to football.
The Birmingham Footy. Dragons.
Footy, as they call it over there.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Yeah, I don't have anything against the English. They're fine.
I love the English. Thank you for your language and your system of government, England. Well, we are here to talk about Nintendo and other video games and E3. It is the week after. Hope you guys are recovering a little bit. I feel okay, actually. I had some comments from people when I got back to work this week who said, "Well, you look like you're doing all right." And I said, "Yeah, you know, actually, this might be the best I've felt after E3 in a long time. Maybe because I was almost dead about halfway through the show and couldn't get out of bed at one point for about 16 hours. But I made a very swift and like potent recovery after that. And by Friday or Saturday, I felt really normal and like almost energized, maybe because I didn't have that nonstop slug of E3. Like, I stayed home half a day at the show, which killed me, but it was the best thing to do. And I think maybe that contributed to me just feeling like almost kind of normal by the time I got back home. Well, we are going to talk a little bit about E3 in a kind of debriefing sense later on, and kind of get a feel for like overall, with just even a little bit of retrospect, how we kind of feel about the show. We've got some listener mails that speak to that and related topics, so we'll try to get to those as well. As usual, first up, we have new business, and Guillaume has a game that's not even out yet as of this recording, and I'm so excited to hear about it.
Right. Well, I'm going to really be quick about it because I've only played less than 2 hours. I got home and I played as much as I could, and I had pizza, and then I recorded this. So not a whole lot of playtime, but I've been playing Shovel Knight. Does anyone not know what Shovel Knight is at this point? I mean, it's been coming for, you know, several years. It's been delayed and delayed and delayed, and finally it's here. But yeah, like, okay, so it's a 2D side-scrolling action game. It's made by former WayForward people. It's very old-school looking, very pixelated, very old-school music. They got a composer from the original Mega Man games to compose a couple of songs for them in there. So, you know, like, they really wear their influences on their sleeve. And they had a Kickstarter as well. And, you know, many of those were stretch goals, right? Like, well, if we receive this much money, we can afford this famous Japanese composer and things like that. So finally, the end result is here. And from what I've played, it's really, really good. I'm not sure exactly, like, you could compare it to so many old good games that we remember fondly, right? Like, the titular character, Shovel Knight, is, of course, a knight with a shovel. And so that's what he swings around to kill enemies. It's a short-range weapon. But you can also use it to jump on their heads when you press down on the D-pad. And that, you know, has basically the same effect as the pogo stick in DuckTales. Except that, unlike in DuckTales, you can't just pogo around all over the place. It's only on enemies that it's effective and that it's going to allow you to reach, you know, new heights and perhaps, you know, get to a platform that you normally couldn't access and maybe find some secrets there. And yes, there are a lot of secrets. Usually it's, you find them by just swinging your axe at, you know, certain walls where there's something off about them, you know, like there are some certain clues that maybe there's something there. Or you're going to have like a succession of enemies and just, you know, serial pogo jump from head to head to make it to a ledge that's really high up and, you know, in the corner of the screen. And it's not even, you know, 100% sure that there's something there, but then you reach it and you move, you know, to the next screen. And of course there's a secret there. And yeah, like there's, so, you know, it's a 2D side scroller, and the levels are separated with a world map. And so, you know, in the levels, you collect a lot of treasure. And this treasure, you can actually go to a town and buy your upgrades. So it has a little bit of, I don't know, like Adventure of Link to it. And these upgrades are really, they seem to be necessary so far. Like, I don't think that you can get away without buying the phasing power-up, which allows you to walk maybe like 2 seconds on spikes, because you're going to need that to get through certain bonus levels or to get through certain challenges within normal levels. You've got other weapons, like you've got kind of a long-range fireball that you can use. You're limited by mana points. You can upgrade your maximum health. You can also buy upgrades for your maximum mana points. And yeah, it's just all around really, really good, and tons of really cute dialogue with the villagers in town. You'll have stupid stuff like a knight, you talk to him by pressing up on the D-pad, of course, like you did in old school games, and he's just like, remember to talk to everyone by pressing up on the D-pad, like you just did right now. you know, like very, you know, tongue-in-cheek. I don't want to spoil it, but there's something very, very early on in the game that's clearly a Link's Awakening reference, and it made my day, you know, and goofy stuff like
a knight who uses a shovel.
Well, yeah, or, you know, like villagers who start dancing for you, kind of like in Final Fantasy IV, you know, like these little sprites doing...
Like they're twirling around and kind of jumping and...
Yeah, and it's just like super simplistic and
yeah,
you know, like you barely see anything, but it's just like, hey, enjoy the show, okay. So yeah, it's pretty damn good. I did make it through another early level where it's set in a graveyard and there's a frequent thunder, and then the screen goes pitch black, and you only see the platforms when there's lightning. And that level already I kind of found pretty frustrating, because you really have to wait for a little while before you can move on and do some platforming. And so yeah, like the difficulty ramps up quite early, but I think that the people who are getting this game wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, Neil's been, and the buzz in general on Twitter today, I think this is kind of the first day or two that people have been talking about it who are reviewing it. And Neil has said he's been dying a lot, which I think for the kind of game this is, like, you want it to be hard, you know?
Sure.
If it's based on things like Mega Man and DuckTales, it should be pretty challenging.
Yeah, and you do have unlimited lives, and you do have checkpoints, although the checkpoints, you can actually smash them, and you gain some more gold, but you don't benefit from a checkpoint. So, you know, risk and reward. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, one last thing that I want to say is that people should actually try playing with a control stick, because I think it actually works better. I was having some difficulty with the D-pad, and then I tried the control stick, and because when you jump, because you have to press down in one of the directions to do your pogo move and still, you know, move left and right, I think it's you can do it more smoothly with a control stick. So it's perfect.
So you're playing on... You're on Wii U?
I'm on Wii U. You can have the action on the gamepad or on the TV, not both at the same time. I'm not sure why. I guess it was simpler for them to do that way. And it's a cool game, and I'm looking forward to playing more.
Yeah, I'm really hyped for this. I backed it on Kickstarter, so I've been excited about it for a long time. But
yeah,
didn't get a chance to play it, but I saw it at PAX East, I think, last year, which was like right after the Kickstarter ended the Kickstarter.
No. So I had no passion for this game, and then it was playable at PAX East, and then I backed the Kickstarter standing on my phone next to the demo station.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, this went from being a game I thought, those motherfuckers don't know what Mega Man is, to thinking, all right.
Right. But it's not straight Mega Man. You do have people to talk
to.
No, it's
not. But I would say Mega Man is the heaviest influence.
Oh, yeah.
Even your character looks like a Mega Man with lots of garbage duct tape to him.
I don't want it to be a straight Mega Man clone, though, because I mean we've already got Mega Man 9 and 10.
But I would say Mega Man is a much heavier influence than DuckTales.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. I got that sense as well. And I'm totally fine with that. So I'm really pumped for it. I'm kind of thinking I might get the 3DS version because I want to see the 3D effect. And because the higher resolution on Wii U does not really do a game like this any favors. So for me, playing it on a smaller screen is probably going to make the game look better. And especially with 3D, that's a unique feature for that version. So I kind of might go that way with it. But it comes out in a week, so I'm super pumped for it. But I guess the only concern I have about playing this on 3DS, it usually isn't an issue for me, but what if the controls aren't as good, John?
That's like a segue or
That's a nice segue. Yeah. So, I'm really tired of talking about Super Mario Bros. 3 at this point. But
because it's so terrible.
But... Well, actually, let me speak to that for a second. The favorite email that we got was somebody bragging about, I believe, how they beat the game in an hour using two warp whistles, and there was a JPEG attached to it with the guy. I don't know if he was given a thumbs up or the finger or what. Anyways, I think he was given a thumbs up, but yeah, he had the ending screen.
Fingers up,
son. He had the ending screen for the game with a thumbs up. And I wanted to respond with one with me holding a finger to the game, but I never did because I'm a classy guy.
I find that his explanation of I beat it in an hour using warp whistles sort of doesn't answer the question that you had with the game.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very different style of playing it, to be fair.
Hold on. I beat this game by bypassing almost all of it.
Yeah. Well, so this kind of – I mean, I'll package this in a I did a Wii U transfer. I did a Wii transfer to my Wii U this week. So, and this is kind of how this tumbled out of it. The Super Mario 3 thing tumbled out of it. So right. I transferred everything over, and that was pretty cool. I was very impressed with the Pikmin splash screen that they have while you're transferring your Wii stuff over to your Wii U. I thought that was a pretty clumsy process, though. I thought it would be simpler than it was.
It's very clumsy. Did you get the advice that to fill up your Wii system memory with as many small games as possible so you don't have to re-download them when you get to the Wii U shop channel?
Yeah, so I sat there and I took about an hour and a half and I copied all of my, moved all of my NES games, which is a sizable amount. Mm-hmm. Copied all of them. I copied actually all of my NES and Super NES games over to the system, to my Wii, and from the SD card. And then transferred everything over. But it was weird. I figured it would be, you would download something, create an archive, and then take the SD card, move it over to your Wii U, and just extract the archive like a zip file kind of thing, right?
Right.
And it's clunkier than that. So, but it worked fine. Nothing went wrong. Everything was cool. I was impressed that it transferred over my points. I was impressed by that. So, yeah, overall that went well, and what I had forgotten about was, and Johnny, I remember this because Johnny mentioned it about the upgrading of games for $1, $1.50, what have you. Because I realized that I actually shouldn't have bought Super Mario World and Super Metroid because I paid full price for those. Not that I care, but I could have upgraded them, but I just didn't realize it. So, but I did upgrade all of my other Super NES games that I bought on Wii. So. It still worked out fine in the end, but
well, all the ones that are available on Wii U, which is a pretty small subset of the ones originally released on Wii.
Yep, but yeah. So one game that also I had a chance to upgrade was Super Mario Bros. 3. So I said, all right, well, let's see how I fare playing Super Mario Bros. 3 on something other than my 3DS. And hot damn, it's about a million times easier when you're actually playing on a gamepad or something with a competent controller because the D-pad and buttons on the 3DS suck. I don't know how they are on the 3DS XL, but the ones on the original 3DS are awful, particularly the D-pad. The D-pad, the problem is that you have to press it so hard to get a response out of it compared to what you have to do on the gamepad. The gamepad, It affords you really, really precise control in Super Mario 3, whereas the D-pad on the 3DS, there's that lag. Remember I was talking about that lag? That's all from the D-pad, because you have to just absolutely crank the D-pad down to get Mario to go where you want. So that's why it's – I mean, it was night and day. I mean, I started playing on the gamepad on Wii U, I should say, and I was able to go through all the way to the end – of the second world in one sitting. I was able to go all the way through to the castle of the second world. Just all the way through. I sat there for like 2 hours just going all the way through it, and it was just no problem whatsoever. I was actually going back into areas and clearing stuff out to go through, you know, optional exits. It was just night and day. So, I mean, it was definitely the control scheme. It's just the 3DS. Playing that game on 3DS is just murder. It's
so
just not
fun.
So you're
saying that Super Mario 3 is terrible is what you're telling me, right?
No. I'm still...
No, he just got good.
Still, I guess I just got good, yeah.
Congrats.
So he got good controls.
Good.
Yeah. The thing is, it still bothers me that when you get sent back to the beginning of a world when you lose all your lives, that's still incredibly stupid to me.
It's very punishing.
Well, the problem that I have with it is there's nothing. Why do they even have a mid-world castle? It just makes
no
sense.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So the mid-world castle doesn't even save your progress. Yeah, that's kind of stupid.
Yeah,
they started doing that in world. You could save at the fortress.
Yeah, and ghost houses
it does,
too.
It's basically the mid-world castle just serves as like a demarcator of, hey, you're halfway there.
Yeah. So
well, and it's also it unlocks the key or it gives you the key to unlock the lock, which usually the lock is preventing you either from getting to the final castle or it's blocking off a shortcut.
Yeah.
I believe there's some like fortresses that you can skip, but I'm not totally sure about that. My memory isn't that strong for this particular game's world maps, but I think there are some that you may be able to go around, but they use those padlocks as motivation to go beat the fortress, even if you skipped it, because there's usually some benefit to doing that.
Yeah, and the other thing with the 3DS controls is that the way I play on the gamepad is I always have the top part of my thumb on B, and then I use kind of like the knuckle of my thumb, I guess you could say, to hit A to jump. That way I'm always turboing, which is typically how you would play on a normal NES gamepad for any of the Mario games. On the 3DS, that's incredibly hard to play that way because you're kind of at odds with how you hold the 3DS. You have to, it's like you're used to kind of almost playing with the 3DS, almost like you're giving a thumbs up, like that you're kind of holding your thumb out forward. But
right.
It kind of forces you, if you want to play that way and have your thumb always on turbo, you have to have your hand kind of off and to the right, which is just awkward to use the 3DS that way. So,
well, or you kind of have to rock your thumb side to side, and that's not a very natural motion. But on Wii U Virtual Console, unlike 3DS Virtual Console, you can remap buttons on every game.
Really? I didn't know that. I haven't messed around with the actual Virtual Console thing because I've actually been playing the game, so I haven't really been mucking around too much. I haven't been using save points or anything like that, so I just...
You also get the save states, which you can do on 3DS. But the Wii U Virtual Console is definitely the best, I think, the best version of Virtual Console. It's kind of, it's a little confusing because, the Wii Virtual Console had a certain set of features, and then the 3DS added save states, for instance, except for the Ambassador games. And, of course, you can put things to sleep just by closing the lid. So that's handy as well in a lot of cases. But then the Wii U Virtual Console... to me is the best because it does add additional features like button layouts and like retro manuals for some things like GBA games. You get the original manuals that are just scanned in, which is really nice.
Yeah.
But you also you still get some degree of portability with the Wii U Virtual Console. I mean, it's not as much as 3DS, but you can move around, you have the off TV play. I really think the Wii U is the best as far as Virtual Console goes. Stuff like Super Dodgeball came out for both, and I've barely ever played that game. I had friends growing up who loved it, but I never really played it with them. And so I'm thinking about picking that up, and I'm like, which platform do I want it on? I mean, it's an NES game, so I might kind of prefer how it looks on the 3DS, but then on the Wii U, you get a lot more options, and it's still kind of portable, so...
I think, to John's point with this game, I think it's going to control better on the Wii U. So I think that's probably the way to go.
Yeah. The Wii U definitely has the best D-pad. I mean, the XL is better than the original 3DS a lot, I think, the D-pad. But I think the Wii U has the best D-pad. And on the Wii U, you can also use something like the Pro Controller, you know, which weighs less than even an XL. And it has just as good of a D-pad, if not even better than the gamepad does.
Yeah, I just want to point out, well, because a listener will if we don't, you can use X button instead of B on the 3DS for NES games. I don't think that you can with Game Boy games, but with NES games, you definitely can. And I don't think I would have made it through Mega Man 2 and 3 on the thing if it hadn't been for that. So it does help. But then again, I'm playing on a 3DS XL, so the D-pad is also better. I understand that the original 3DS, it's not great.
Yeah, it's, and the thing is, I never really encountered this until playing this game where really precise control is at a premium. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I was going back to the 3DS and I was like, wow, I wouldn't say unplayable, but man, it's hard. It's a real pain in the ass.
It's a handicap, it's difficult. At least.
It is. It's a huge handicap.
And it may be better if you have an XL. You might not even notice this or even have an issue with it. But man, I mean, I've been telling you for years, John, the XL is a pretty big upgrade over the original. It's not just bigger, it's better. They improved the hardware a lot.
Yeah, it definitely got the wheels turning because I'm looking at my 3DS
it's
in a whole
hard to swallow that cost, but I don't think you'll regret it.
Yeah. So Super Mario Brothers 3 coming back into my good graces a little bit, you know. Still kind of mad at it, but, you know, it's okay. It's okay. I'm letting him back into the house. But he's sleeping downstairs on the couch. So she is. She is. She is.
She, your lady friend Mario 3.
Whoa.
But I have another.
Back now.
I have another. I have a surprise for you guys. I got Mario Kart 8 today.
Whoa.
Nice. Yeah. So
just today. So just today. Yeah. Grand Prix trophies.
Came in the mail today. No, I haven't had that much time. I've only had a couple of hours, so I've only beaten like half of the 50cc Grand Prix. But yeah, I'm liking it a lot. It's Mario Kart. I mean, you know, I played the hell out of Mario Kart Wii. So, I mean, you can just pick it up and just pick up where you left off pretty much.
Mm-hmm. It's tracks, like that, but better.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the HD upgrade is huge. It's a big improvement. The only thing is it feels kind of slow right now. I don't know if that's just 50cc.
You're playing on 50cc.
I'm wondering. I'm hoping that it speeds up.
Right. Also known as tourism mode.
Right. Yeah,
You don't. You don't have to go through the whole game at 50cc. You can play at 100 or 150, and if you unlock like the 3 stars for those speeds, you will get also the reward for the 50cc. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, and a lot of earlier Mario Karts, you did at some point have to, if you want to unlock everything, you did have to play through the 50.
Right.
You're perfectly good enough to play the 100 or 150. But
right.
In this game, you can jump to the higher ones and it'll unlock the earlier. Now, want to start with 100 because 150 is pretty hard. So,
it is.
You know, you might get kind of frustrated if you're just trying to skip straight to 150. But I think 100 is, you know, very doable. It'll give you enough of a challenge that, you know, you might have to go back and do one or two again to get the gold. But for the most part, you're not going to have a ton of trouble with it. And you'll still be able to learn the tracks, but you won't be bored. Because I think 50cc is just straight up boring. If you've played 7 other Mario Karts before this, you really don't need to mess with 50cc at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm playing through it only because I thought I had to unlock everything.
Yeah, no, you can skip
it. You know?
Yeah, you can jump ahead.
Over the last weekend, I had the experience of going to a party where everyone was playing Mario Kart 8, and it really, you know, like a lot of people were just beginners and hadn't played Mario Kart in a while, or maybe had never played a Mario Kart, and it is a hard game to explain. Like, there's so many things that, like, how do you do the boosts, and how you power slide, and what's the best way to power slide. Like, what I was saying maybe 2 weeks ago about Karen, my girlfriend, it's just like it's true for every beginner, and there's a lot of, I don't know, there's a steep learning curve, I think. So 50cc has its place, I think. Beginners are really happy that it's there, but I'm glad that
we'll just skip. My point is, John is not a beginner, so but also, I mean, I think if you're in a social environment like that, you might not want to try to get too deep into the technical parts of the racing engine, because like a lot of Nintendo games, you might not think of it this way, but I think Mario Kart is a game that you can sort of make it more difficult for yourself if that's how you want to play, and you'll get more out of it when you do so. But you can have fun in the game without knowing how to power slide. without knowing how to do all those boosts, without knowing how to do tricks off of ramps. That could be something you learn after you've played it for a couple hours. You don't have to teach that to someone right away.
Right, but, you know, like, people will choose whatever card or bike they think that they want at the beginning, and they're not really going to understand the stats, and in a lot of cases, it's just going to be impossible to take certain turns, even in the early tracks, without power sliding. Like, they'll just have picked the wrong vehicle. So there's, again, that extra layer of complexity that kind of muddies everything.
Yeah, you're right about that. And I've said it before a couple weeks ago that they really should have a basic interface for choosing a cart if you don't want to go through the customization stuff.
Yeah.
Because if you just slam the button through and just pick three random parts, you're not going to know how to drive that thing. I mean, because there's not an option to just like choose a simple loadout, I always recommend that people just try to pick things that give them really high handling. Because that makes it a lot easier. If you can't stay on the track, you're not going to win. I don't care how fast you are. I don't care how much acceleration you have or whatever. You've got to stay on the track if you want to be competitive. So crank up the handling, even at the sacrifice of other stats. And then as you get better at the game and you learn the track layouts and you can handle, you know, you can do with less margin for error on those big turns, then you can cut down on the handling and add performance in other areas. But handling really is the beginner's friend, you know.
Absolutely.
I would always recommend that people maximize. I mean, I've played a shitload of Mario Kart. I still choose carts with a lot of handling. I mean, not at the expense of everything, but if it doesn't have at least halfway up the handling meter, I'm not driving it because it's just too frustrating for me.
Plus, it's, you know, safety first. You're a careful driver.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing I don't like about it is that it kind of introduces the concept of a best build for your cart, which is sort of complexity I don't want.
Yeah, Obi was like running spreadsheets and talking about like min-maxing.
The first thing I thought of is like, okay, that means that for the hardest tracks in the game, there's probably a best combination that you can pick, and I don't want to go through the effort of finding out what that is. You know what I'm
also
saying?
Also, there's also a best combination for you, for your style, for your skill level. Mm-hmm. And the other part is that, you know, there's a lot of pieces of carts in the game to unlock, and some of them that you'll get later on are just straight up better, you know?
Yeah.
So, they still have pros and cons, but the pros will be much stronger than the cons are debilitating. So you'll find parts later on that you can use to build an overall much stronger cart than you could at the beginning of the game. And so, you know, which is exciting because you do feel like you're getting rewarded as you play the game, and you unlock those just from getting coins. Even if you lose a Grand Prix, you might still unlock a new piece. And that may be the key to you going back and winning gold next time. I mean, that I like that. I just don't – I feel like that should be kind of an optional way to play the game. And I feel like beginners should have access to, you know, pre-made carts that are just, you know – just straightforward, you know, hop into it. The other thing is you can always tell them to use a bike because the bikes tend to be a little easier to turn in.
Yeah.
Not every bike, but.
Not everyone, but a lot of them have pretty high handling and then they sacrifice other things.
Yeah.
But for beginners, I think they can be good.
Yeah, but I understand where John is coming from because if there is an ultimate combination, then you got to wonder, even if there's one that you might be more comfortable with, it's still raises the question, is it worth getting used to anything else other than the ultimate best vehicle, you know?
Yep. And you run into this in all sorts of games. I mean, ultimately, the first thing, no matter how many options that are given to the player, the first thing is, what's the best build? Somebody figure that out. It happens in first-person shooters, MMOs, and I don't need that kind of thing in Mario Kart. You know what I mean?
Right, and you don't want to end up in a race online in Mario Kart and, everyone is Rosalina. That's
yeah,
all.
Yeah. Everybody's using the same cart. But
yeah, no, that's who everybody seems to use, by the way, the characters. I played a little bit of online, and I was interesting, so it must be her that they're using, because I know it was either Daisy or Peach or somebody, and I think it must have been probably Rosalina then.
Right.
Do they all vote for the same track? Because that's probably the one where they found an exploit.
Yeah. Yep. Mm. So, no, but I mean, all that aside, it's love it. It's great. I mean, it's really, really good.
And the good thing is, I mean, this game's patchable, especially if you're going to play online, then they can force a patch to you through the online mode. So if they find out that the game is unbalanced or that a certain character is kind of overpowered, they can fix that. And that's not really been the case in past Mario Kart games. I mean, they did they pushed a patch in 7 to fix some level shortcuts, but you know, that were unintentional. But I don't think they ever like rebalanced characters or anything. But in 8, I think that's more likely to happen. But we'll see. I have not been playing it as much lately since before E3, and I'm going to try to get some people over tomorrow night and play a bunch of Mario Kart, and I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, let me know, because, I mean, we're definitely going to get some community night action for NWR going.
Oh, online. For sure. Yeah, yep. I think we probably would have been doing more of that, except E3 kind of, you know, derailed us on a lot of things like that. But we're not nearly done with Mario Kart 8 coverage. And just, you know, social events through the game, too.
To James's great joy.
And I think that game will continue to get updates.
Actually, breaking news, we are completely done with Mario Kart coverage. So go home, everybody.
Wrong.
I just got the announcement now. So we're actually completely done. So, all right, everybody, have a good time.
Not so. But
that'll
James,
do it for RFN this week.
No, actually, it's your turn, James. Now, may be the end of people's listening enjoyment, but the show is still ongoing, and it's all on your shoulders.
People are here.
Just skip this chapter, everybody. Just go ahead.
So the fact that this is why the chapter have people will actually start caring at, I'm sorry. That's not my fault. Anyway, I've been playing Etrian Odyssey 4. I don't have a whole lot to say about it because it's an old game. It was the game I had grabbed for my airplane game, and ultimately I didn't play on the airplane, but I did get some time with it. I played it a bit while we were driving on Friday. I played it a bit in the hotel room while I was kind of getting ready in the mornings, and I've played it a bit since I got back. Through the first area, and I mean, it's an Etrian Odyssey game. It's going to appeal to a very limited number of people, and that is a subset of people who already enjoy JRPGs, because it doesn't give you anything, effectively.
I'm not sure. Well, yeah, okay. No, I am a fan of JRPGs, but I do think that they explain a lot. Carry on.
What it gives you versus a traditional JRPG, even simple stuff like, hey, here's a map. I mean, it's much... much more on you to figure out how to build your character parties, what combination of characters to use, how to proceed through a level. There's no real immediate sense of, hey, you're ready to go fight that boss, short of, hey, I'm going to go fight that boss and see what happens. A lot of the game is sort of based around what you're willing to attempt to do and ultimately how you interpret the information it's giving you. It's very much less willing to just guide you along a path as a lot of JRPGs that have come out in the last decade or so. It's a wholly different experience than playing most games in that genre.
No, I think that's fair. Like, it's not like your village was burned down and you were forced, you know, away from home and you meet people along the way. It's really, you create your party right away. And there are different classes to choose from. You have to spend quite a bit of time in the menus to figure out exactly what they do, although, you know, some names are pretty evocative, like the fortress, I'm pretty sure is good at defending, etc. I think that's fair, but at the same time, I think that all the information is there, you know, and it is there to be read, and that's not the case in really old school RPGs where you needed the manual and you couldn't figure out what certain options did unless you read about it somewhere, you know.
Well, like I said, in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So I don't think a JRPG from a major publisher has come out that is this relatively opaque in a while. With the exception of other Etrian Odyssey games.
Right. So they made Etrian Odyssey Untold, where you have the story mode, and I think it's a little bit more handholdy and it's more linear. But,
right. I mean, my biggest problem has been this moment of, hey, I've sort of mapped this whole area. I don't necessarily know that I'm ready to fight the boss, and I don't necessarily have a indicator that I'm ready. I had this area mapped for a while now. I don't know if I've gained enough levels that I can have a go at it, or if I'm still way too weak. I can.
Yeah, to me, the game should be balanced such that if you've explored the entire dungeon and mapped every single corner of it, you should be ready to fight that boss.
And that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. Well, this game has, I mean, my impression of it from playing the demo, which I enjoyed, but then I never bought the game mainly because of stuff I heard from people like Guillaume and others who said the game kind of turns into a slog. And I know you liked it a lot, Guillaume, but you know, this idea of the game just going on and on and on and on and getting really difficult towards the end, not super appealing to me. So it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that, but
I don't think it was really, I think it was rewarding throughout. It is difficult, but I don't think that it was really, like, I didn't have to grind as much as certain other RPGs that are more linear, you know? Like, it's really that you have to, you can make a lot of choices, and there are a lot of ways to screw yourself over.
Yeah, I mean, to the point of grinding, I didn't necessarily feel like I needed to grind. I just didn't have any clear indication of, hey, I'm ready versus, hey, I'm not. And while I could just go after the boss, the problem is usually that it takes such a long time to get to the boss, even when you've sort of unlocked these shortcuts, that the idea of going to face the boss, knowing that I'm likely sacrificing myself, isn't super appealing. And that can be somewhat frustrating. So ultimately, I did sort of clear the boss of the first area, and it took some doing, but it's a kind of a tricky situation to deal with. I mean, I knew that I could handle the FOEs, which is these kind of moving strong level enemies that I was facing, but in the boss's area, there were two that kind of hover around him, so I'm sort of looking at going, I don't know if I want to do this. It takes a certain amount of just going, well, I'll just deal with the consequences of whatever happens. And
can you lure them away? You know, be a little strategic about it. And
the game actually suggests luring them away. I just couldn't figure out where to take them in such a way that they wouldn't snap back to their normal path and become an issue. So I was kind of trying to figure out what to do with them and how to manage them. And ultimately, I just aced them. And then moved on to the boss. And that required me to spend a ton of money on restorative items because ultimately I needed to get back to being in good shape to fight the boss.
I mean, couldn't you have left, like going back to the inn at town and then come back and then beat the boss after you killed the FOEs?
There's a possibility they would have respawned.
Oh my God.
Yeah, really? So the FOEs in general respawn, except for the bosses.
Yeah, but it takes a certain time. I think you could have spent like one day at the inn and come back and you would have been fine. But then again, you wouldn't know that unless you did it. So I kind of
understand.
Unless
I tried.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to take that risk, so I just spent, you know, a couple thousand on items and said, all right.
Yeah, fair enough.
See what happens.
Let's roll the dice, yeah.
It does feel like, to an extent, you kind of have to just sort of know that you're ready, that there's not necessarily a clean indicator. So,
well, I mean, RPGs, it's not like they have a little thing that lights up and says, no, it's boss time. But usually you should be able to tell based on, you know, how much trouble are you having with the normal enemies around the boss.
And if you're handling them
pretty easily, then, you know, you can expect the boss will be harder than that, but you can probably handle it.
I was murking the average enemy multiple levels before I was ready to actually fight the boss. And it does feel like, to an extent, you have to kill a lot of low-level enemies. The quests that the game gives you are a really good way to earn experience really quickly. But unfortunately, I didn't feel like the game was giving me enough quests to really sort of get to where I needed to get. So I cleared out all the quests pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's probably more of an issue early in the game.
It could well be that later in the game.
You're probably not going to have as many options. You know,
right, it could well be that later in the game this isn't as much of an issue. But it was a little bit frustrating at this point in the game to sit there and go, okay, so do I just need to keep killing enemies until I get to where I need to get? Because I've been doing this for like a day. And ultimately, that's what I ended up having to do. The game does give you more dungeons to play in to sort of gain experience, but I didn't feel like that these supplemental dungeons that are basically there to give you stuff to grind against really provided a significant boost in experience. So it wasn't bad. It was just kind of sometimes it felt a little frustrating. Like it took a little bit of the piss out of the whole experience. The other thing that I observed is that if you attempt to build up multiple parties, the different classes of party member, beyond the five you're allowed to carry with you in battle, you're going to slow your game down significantly.
Oh, yeah.
So I had to abandon one of the party members that I was trying to level up as well, but that meant that I didn't necessarily know that I had the five best classes for what I was attempting to accomplish.
Yeah.
I could have just taken some of the stuff that I got from Street Passing at E3 and maybe made this whole thing seem passé, but I have opted to not just break the game outright, but we'll see. I don't necessarily know how to use the Street Pass information, but I did Street Pass a lot of level 99s. So if you can just straight up use them in your party, I may be able to just shatter the game in seconds.
Well, hold on. Real quick clarification. When you said having too many people in your party slowed it down, do you mean like performance-wise the game got
chugged? No. So you can carry around five people, but you can have more people in your guild. And at the start of the game, it gives you a choice of like six or seven classes. And I didn't necessarily know which classes were the ones I wanted to use, so I was trying to experiment with them. And that meant that a lot of times I was having to swap them out to gain them levels so I could figure out if they had skills I actually felt were useful in this
scenario. Oh, sure, like in Pokemon.
Right. And yes. But it's slower than Pokemon. And so it took some doing to kind of figure out the five I wanted to use. And in the end, I ended up having to just go, all right, these are my five. If it doesn't work, fuck. I'll deal with it.
I have a question for both of you guys, because you're my Etrian Odyssey experts. But you also both have a history with, other Atlas games, including Persona. And, you know, we know that Persona Q just came out in Japan. It's the next game by the people who made Etrian Odyssey 4. And in some ways, it's similar to Etrian Odyssey. But, of course, it has this, chibi version of Persona slapped onto it. So, how curious are you guys about that? Is that appealing to you?
So I'm fairly curious about the game. It is my understanding, for people who are playing it right now, that it is significantly, I don't want to say more approachable, but more straightforward with stuff than the EO games. Although, I mean, it is effectively an EO game with Persona stuff on top of it.
Right.
So it sort of rounds off the corners on a lot of the stuff that makes EO EO. And that may turn off some people who are hardcore Etrian Odyssey fans, but I think ultimately they were trying to strike a balance between Persona fans and Etrian Odyssey fans in order to maximize their gains as a combined franchise opportunity for Atlas Corporation.
Yeah. Maximize.
Persona is not exactly simplistic either, but it's complex in different ways.
Right. It's not a mechanically necessarily complicated game.
Right.
Yeah, and it's more narrative-driven, and it's more linear, certainly. I haven't really read that much about Persona Q, but I do have it pre-ordered already. I can't wait. I'm a fan of both franchises, so it's kind of...
When's it coming out here?
Isn't it like September or October?
Yeah, it's September-October is what I was told at E3.
Okay, well, that'll be a big game for the fall then.
Yeah, it just came out in Japan. It wasn't really at
E3, I feel like it's not as hyped up as it probably could be because, you know, it had just come out in Japan.
It had been out for a week in Japan when E3 happened.
And they don't have anything in English to show yet, so they didn't really have it at E3, which is unfortunate. Because I feel like there's probably plenty of interest. I bet a lot of people went by there saying, hey, you guys got Persona Q? And they're like, no, not really.
Yeah, they didn't show
this Japanese copy, but we don't even want you to touch it.
They didn't show either of the handheld Persona games at E3, at least not officially. But I mean, the Vita game, the Hatsune Miku Persona game, that's so Tokyo Game Show that it had to be shown there first.
Oh yeah.
That is the Japanese-iest game possibly ever.
Well, in Persona 5, I think we'll be at TGS as well.
Yeah, that's going to get a big blowout at TGS.
Yeah. And that's for PlayStation 3.
Yep. Yes.
And that's also pre-ordered.
It is interesting that they've combined Persona with these other franchises to sort of market both at the same time for their handheld games.
I think it's clever as long as they don't overdo it. Like, you know, if this is their Fabula Nova Crystallis or whatever,
we don't speak of Fabula Nova Crystallis in polite society.
I mean, you can do this once and I think people will be cool with it and they'll be interested. If you keep trying to do this over and over, I think fans of these other series are going to feel a little bit betrayed. They're like, you know what? Persona is already popular. I don't really need you to put Persona in my blank.
Rather you just make Hatsune Miku.
They've already made like a Persona fighting game, and
they're making a sequel to the Persona fighting game. That was the big game Atlus had at their E3 booth.
Yeah, for some reason people seem to like it. Like, it looks like it's a competent fighting
Persona
game.
Persona 4 Arena is supposed to be pretty good. I mean,
I did try it for an hour. Like, PSN Plus allows you for a 1 hour trial, and I tried the story mode, and the cutscenes would be like half an hour long.
Yeah, so Persona 4 Arena, as my understanding, is a story sequel, as in it is the continuation of the plot of Persona 4. Wow. So it is canonical, which means they're going to throw long videos at you when you play that game.
Yeah. Not videos, more like stills and
text. Well, yeah, I mean videos as defined by the Persona series.
Visual novel style. But I just want to throw this out there as an open letter to Atlus. If you want to make a Persona-themed surgery simulator, I'm cool with that. I'm really cool with that.
I would much rather you just go ahead and make Trauma Team 2, please. I don't necessarily need Persona Team. Thank you.
I would rather have a new Trauma Team, but if they want to slap Persona characters in there, it probably wouldn't be that much different anyway.
I'm not sure I want to have my surgery performed on me by high schoolers with magical powers.
Atlus, please give me Trauma Odyssey.
I'd much rather have my surgery performed by a luchador. Thank you.
All right. Well, moving on. I'm going to speak very quickly about Pushmo World because it came out today. I played it for 15 minutes. I made it through the tutorial levels.
Oh, God.
I can confirm that it is indeed very much Pushmo. It really... You know, I mean, I've heard that they add some new features to the puzzles as you get deeper in the game that are not, you know, reused from the 3DS game. I haven't gotten to that stuff yet. I'm looking forward to it. And I'm looking forward to just playing more Pushmo. I mean, I didn't really buy this because I was excited about new features or even because I was interested in, you know, the level editor or anything like that. I certainly didn't buy it for the HD graphics because the game, you know, I mean, it looks like Pushmo, and Pushmo's an attractive game on the 3DS, but going to high definition really doesn't add anything to this game, and they didn't do a whole lot with it. Like, the backgrounds are pretty spare.
Yeah, and do you think that losing the 3D makes it lose a lot, or?
So far, it hasn't bothered me, but, you know, and I think it will be one of those things that it's never going to bother me. But then if I go back and play Pushmo, or probably more likely I'd go back and play Crashmo, because I played through most of the original Pushmo. I you know, more or less beat it. I played most of the levels. So I think Crashmo was the one I played a little while. It seemed really hard. I couldn't quite wrap my head around it. And then I got distracted by something else. So I think when I go back to Crashmo soon is what I'm hoping. I suspect that the 3D effect will be really striking because I've been playing without it on Wii U and in Pushmo World. But I never felt that the 3D was needed to play Pushmo. I just felt that it looked nice, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's a game about depth. So the puzzles are depth based. And so having the 3D effect, you feel like you're interacting with the stereoscopic depth of the screen often. And that's like sort of visually and mentally satisfying as you do that. But I never felt like it clarified anything really. I mean, you could always move the camera and you can still do that. You can use the R joystick to move the camera left and right and, you know, get a better angle. And that's not something I ever really needed to do much either, but it's there if you have trouble making a certain jump or you can't tell how far out you've pulled the block. So I don't really think the loss of 3D is like I don't think it's like a functional or a critical loss. You know, I liked the 3D effect. I usually like the 3D effect in 3DS games, but I don't think it's really a problem. You know, it plays fine. Grandpa is still super annoying, and I wish he would just hurry up and die so I could play these levels without him yakking at me constantly.
There needs to be a I'm not a beginner option in these games.
This is the third game in this series. Like, guys, probably most of the people playing this on Wii U have played another game in this series.
Is there anything resembling even the slightest bit of challenge in this game, or should I just go ahead?
Dude, I've played it for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I mean, to me, the 3DS game, it took a while, but it did get pretty challenging. And then when I went to Crashmo, it was like, oh, God, this is way harder than Pushmo. And I would imagine Pushmo World will be somewhere, you know, back closer to the first game. I would be actually happy about that. But I'm sure that it will get challenging in the deeper levels. Yes, I'm sure that it will. But I haven't experienced that for myself yet. So anyway, I bought Pushmo World just mainly because I like Pushmo, and I figured I would. It's probably not something I'm going to marathon, but it's something that, you know, will always be in my Wii U until the end of time now. And I will go back to it periodically and play it for 15 minutes and then put it down and then it'll play something else. And that's good. That's what I want out of Pushmo. So
one thing that I'm annoyed at Nintendo of America for is that they decided to put a discount for the 3DS games when this game came out. You know, like, oh, well, like we've got this upcoming Wii U game. So why don't you pay less for these two, or like if you skip them? And meanwhile, in Japan and Europe, they give a discount if you already own Pushmo or Crashmo, then you get a discount on the Wii U game, which I think is, you know, the more customer friendly move. I mean, like, you're rewarding the people who actually bought the first games instead of being like, well, we're gonna try to, I don't know, like, to,
you're right,
yeah,
you're
go
right.
backwards, right?
But this game is $10. I mean, much of a discount do you really need when it's $10?
But if it's mostly the same game that I've already played,
it's not. Well, it's not. I mean, it's new levels. It's all new levels. It's not. Yeah, it's not a level pack. It's not a rehash. It's the same mechanics for the most part. But it's all new content. There's like 250 levels plus an editor. Plus you can share levels between the 3DS game and the Wii U game, and on Miiverse. And there's stamps in it. I have no issue with the value proposition of this game. I mean, I'm not going to argue against a discount. I'm always happy to take a discount, but I don't think we're being slighted by the lack thereof. It's a cheap game, and there's a lot of content in it. So I just, that's not worth picking nits over. You know, another game that I did get a discount on, actually, and I don't have to talk about this very long either because it's super short, is Metal Gear Solid Ground Zeroes. I thought $30 for the PS4 version of this was absurd, and I was never going to pay $30 for it. I have only a passing interest in Metal Gear Solid in the first place. I've played 1 through 4, sort of somewhat begrudgingly in some cases, and I'm fairly awful at all of them. I think it's a series that it's, especially if you've never played any Metal Gear Solid, it's worth playing through at least one just so you can kind of grok what the hell people are talking about with the series, because it's not really like any other game series I can think of. And even if you don't really like it that much, it's worth just sitting down with a guide and just marching through one of these games so you get a feel for, like, what is it that drives people so crazy about these games, and like, why are they so weird, and like, you know, what the hell are they even? Because it's kind of hard to explain to people. It's hard to explain the appeal, hard to explain the flaws in the series. It's hard to explain the story to anyone, including Kojima himself. But, you know, Ground Zeroes is really short. I beat it in about 2 hours, and that's with a lot of, like, deaths and retries. Like, if I was actually competent at this, I could have blown through it in less than half the time. So it is very short. You know, it's open. It's, they call it open world. It's probably more like open town is probably a better way to put it, because the area that you're exploring is really not that big. But, you know, there are a lot of different routes you can take, and this is the kind of game where taking a different route could give you a very different experience. So I think I might play through it at least one more time to just kind of see different parts of it. But, like, I'm not in a hurry, because frankly, I didn't like it that much.
So this is a prologue to Metal Gear Solid 5, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. And, you know, and I don't know if I'm going to play MGS5, The Phantom Pain. I'm kind of waiting for reviews. Like, that's how much I care about this series. Like, I'm not even really sure I want to play the new one. To me, Metal Gear Solid, it's weird that it's so popular because it is fantastically bizarre and, like, very, like, really strange to play, like, really kind of, I think, deeply frustrating and irritating in a lot of ways, just the playing of it. And that's not to say it can't be fun, but to me it's fun, like, very sporadically. Like, there's a lot of frustration, and then every now and then things kind of work, and I'm like, oh, cool, you know. And sometimes I learn how to do something better, and that's nice. But a lot of times when something goes wrong in this game, I don't know why, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what I did wrong, and the game really doesn't tell me. And sometimes when things go wrong and I manage to like escape and like salvage the situation. I'm not really sure why it worked that time when it didn't all the other times. Mm-hmm. And that I really felt that way playing Ground Zeroes. There were a couple of situations where I died a whole bunch of times and I just kept trying different things, but I couldn't tell you why I eventually got out of the situation. Like I just kept doing things until something worked. And I don't really get a sense that that thing was a smarter strategy than the other things I was doing. A lot of times I felt like, oh, okay, I kind of see where I should go around this building and then underneath the thing. And then I should like shoot the camera. And I would have this plan that to me seemed very logical and it seemed to address the problems that I was having with the other things I'd been trying. And then that wouldn't work either. You know,
gameplay is still stealth based, right? I mean, it's still,
yeah.
It's the same thing. You either have a choice between going full stealth or killing everybody and, you know,
well, it's
risking,
not
risking the consequences.
That's one thing. If you haven't played Metal Gear, if you haven't played a lot of Metal Gear, you might get the sense that you either have to play through the game without killing anybody or you have to kill everybody. And that's the wrong way to play it. In truth, any way you can get through the game is the right way, in my opinion. Because I think these games are hard and kind of opaque. You know, like they don't explain the mechanics very well. They never have. And they're usually, I mean, to their credit, there usually is more than one way to get through a situation. And any way you get through it is fine. I mean, the game's not really going to punish you down the road. I mean, they score you at the end of missions. And if you shoot a bunch of dudes, then they dock you points. But who cares, you know? Like you're probably playing it to see the next bizarro cutscene anyway.
Yeah.
But I felt even that was a disappointment in this game. I mean, the graphics are great. You know, I'm playing on PS4. You can kind of tell that it's a cross-gen game because they released this on 360 and PS3 as well. And it's not the best looking PS4 game, I think. Probably Phantom Pain will be a lot better, I'm guessing, because I think that's only on the new systems. But the cutscenes really, I didn't find very interesting. Part of why people like these games, the cutscenes are super crazy and the characters are like really over the top. And I didn't really think that was the case for Ground Zeroes. It's all
well,
very
that,
kind
that's
of...
the thing though, right? Like, Kojima said he wanted to make a more serious game, but then there's still stupid stuff in there. Like there's still comic book nonsense.
Yeah,
so like
there's not enough for my taste, frankly, because that stuff, like, it doesn't make any more sense than all the crazy conspiracy theories, but it's more fun if you're not totally invested in the crazy labyrinth
stupid
plot.
In ways that make it more approachable.
Yeah, you can enjoy that stuff on a surface level. It's like this dude has a swarm of bees flying around him and he, you know, cackles like a supervillain. Like that doesn't even fit into this universe. But that's also why I can appreciate it, because I don't know what the fuck's going on with Lolly Lulelo. You know, I don't know who all these people are. So Ground Zeroes was really kind of lacking in the wackiness that, you know, like is like it or not, that is part of Metal Gear, and it has been for 20 years. So if they're going to cut that out, I think it's going to turn a lot of people off, turn me off, and I'm not even that big of a fan in the first place. So we've got one more game to talk about in new business, but since we're running a little bit long already, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back after Now Playing, we're going to talk about Tomodachi Life, and then we're going to talk about E3, maybe get some emails. See you over there.
Hello, it's me, Luigi. You're listening to Radio Free Nintendo. Number one! Ho ho! I did it. Good job, bro.
And we're back. In an unusual move, we're going to conclude new business in the second segment, and we'll do it with a game that I've been playing a little bit, but Guillaume is really the best person to carry us forward on this one.
Right. I've been holding out for like 3 weeks now and talking about this game, and hopefully these 3 weeks will allow me to talk about what the hell it's about, because it's a hard game to talk about.
Game is kind of a strong statement already.
Yeah. Right. This so app. Let's get into that. Tomodachi Life. What the hell is it?
It's kind of like an aquarium for your Miis.
Well, yeah, actually, that's a pretty good description. You plup your Miis in this game, and so they're dropped in an apartment building. You can choose a voice for them with different options, like there's sliders for like the pitch and the speed or the voice, etc. And that allows you to kind of create an approximation of what the person might sound like in real life.
Yeah, but not really. They just all sound like funny little robots. And there's a lot of variety.
You could create that person's voice assuming they were a terrible robot.
Yeah, sure.
You can make a lot of different sounding voices, but they all sound like different flavors of robot.
Yeah, sure. All right, that's fair enough. But anyway, the voice is kind of important because all the text in the game will be said out loud. It is, you know, generated by the game. And so that leads to a lot of fun things. So you choose a voice for them, and you can also choose, like, a personality. So now that your Miis have voices and personalities, they all have their own apartment on your little Tomodachi Island. And they all have their little problems, and these problems are, I don't know, like they might be hungry, so you buy food and you feed them, or they'll ask you, look inside my head, and you're like, okay. And then you know, like you touch the screen, you touch their heads, and you see what's inside their brain. Sometimes it might be like an impossible to win tic-tac-toe game. Sometimes it might just be completely empty. And then they're like, now you know what's been on my mind today. And that's it. Like you've completed the requirement just by doing what they asked, and then their little happiness meter goes up.
I am violently shaking my head now in confusion.
So what I'm saying is that you're completing these, you know, quote-unquote tasks for them, but there is not really any game. There's no puzzle to solve. There's no, like, you're basically taking care of a Tamagotchi, I guess.
Yeah, there aren't even really objectives. I mean, not even in the sense of like Animal Crossing, where you can build up your town and you can earn a lot of money and you can make a bigger house and you can do these things. You can win competitions. Tomodachi doesn't have any of that.
But you can make Shaq sing opera.
Yeah, like they've got a happiness meter, and when that happiness meter is full, then they gain a level, and that allows you to give them a catchphrase or give them some gift. Like you can give them 3DSs, and if you give everyone 3DSs on your island, they might start hanging out and play 3DS together and things like that. But otherwise, like, when you level them up, there's no ultimate goal there. You're just leveling them up to level them up, you know? Mm-hmm. And also, they will develop relationships. They will ask you, like, oh, I heard that so-and-so wants to be friends. What do you think? And you tell them, well, I think it's a swell idea. And then they'll go, okay, I'll go scope things out. And then you see a little animation of them meeting that person and befriending them, and that's it. Now they're friends, and they're going to start hanging out.
So could you just tell them all, no, I think it's a terrible idea, and create a bunch of socially
awkward
Miis?
Oh, absolutely. You can bet that I tried to break some relationships in that game, because I don't necessarily want my parents to hang out with anyone else than each other. There are some things that are just too, you know, like, I'm, call me old-fashioned, but I don't want my dad to be dating, like, my friend's wife. Even if it's just Miis and it's all innocent.
Hey,
it's just,
we all need love sometimes.
Hey, it's just a non-game, all right, guys?
So, Guy, I have some questions for you. I've been playing it, but not that much. I haven't put a lot of time into it yet. And I certainly plan to you know, spend more time with it.
Yeah, but, ask the guy who's spent like 23 hours in this game.
Okay, yes, I do actually have some questions for it. Because I have to say, like, I've maybe played it for 2 or 3 hours. Not a lot going on yet. I think you need to invest a surprising amount of time and effort into importing Miis from the Mii Maker, or this is a stupid process, but like anyone you found in Street Pass, you can get them into the game, but first you have to send them from the Street Pass Plaza into Mii Maker, and then you can import them from Mii Maker into Tomodachi Life, because that makes sense.
Right.
So,
it's complicated.
And then, of course, importing them takes some work also, because you do have to create a personality and you have to customize a voice. Or maybe you can do QR codes, but that means you have to troll the internet and try to find QR codes. And that option, I think, doesn't even open up right away. The Street Pass didn't open until I'd put about 3 hours into it after E3. Thanks, Nintendo. I love how you do that. I love how one of the core features of the game takes 3 hours for you to turn on, because that's real useful. But, you know, I've seen a lot of people on Twitter, on Facebook, posting these screenshots of all the crazy events that happen. And these are not even they're not things you set up directly. They're, you know, you set variables and then the game matches people and it throws people or groups of people into strange situations that you just sort of view and they're funny and you're supposed to share them with friends. How do you share them with friends? Is there like a Twitter button in the game? Because I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, you unlock it eventually.
Fuck! Nintendo! Fuck!
Yeah, I know. I love you, Nintendo. So just from the get-go, things to aggravate Johnny. I'm happy with this.
Yeah.
So from the get-go, they do give you the ability to take screenshots of the top and bottom screen. It's as simple as pressing X or Y buttons, but they don't tell you that right away.
Those go to your SD card. What the fuck am I going to do with that?
They do, but eventually you unlock like a little part of your island. It's like, oh, here you can share photos on the internet. And so you can choose to send them to, I think, Tumblr. I've never used Tumblr. You can send them to Facebook or to Twitter. So those
That's
are your
a good decision.
Never using Tumblr. Yeah, I figure.
Yes.
But yeah, like, so you've got these three social networks that you can send your stuff to. So that's pretty easy. As for video stuff, I did share a video on Vimeo of all websites, but I had to film that with my iPhone. So there's no video option here.
Okay.
But photos are pretty easy to share.
Eventually,
like your description of how to end Mii's and how it's time consuming, it is, and that's definitely a problem with the game. I think that you get more enjoyment out of it the more work you put into it, but I'm also in an ideal situation where Karen also bought the game for herself, and so she made all the Mii's of, you know, all the people she knows and all her family, and I made Mii's of all my family and the people I know. And so we've been just, you know, through the wireless link, we've been sending each other these Mii's that each of us made on, you know, on our own. And so that kind of have the work. It's like there's space for 80 freaking Mii's on the island. And I've got 23. And so like my apartment building is nowhere near, you know, full capacity. And it's very time consuming. So I can understand. I'm kind of grateful. Like I haven't check them out yet, but I'm grateful that Nintendo has some celebrity Mii's, because I'm going to have to add filler at some point. Like at this point, I've pretty much added most of my real life friends, and I need, I guess, like who else could I add? Maybe my coworkers, and then it's just, I'm running out of people, so I'm going to have
to get
something.
Us in there.
Yeah,
I mean, I've already got James and John. I think I have you too, Guillaume.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that you're going to send me.
I don't approve of my image being used this way.
I'm going to send out my QR code. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
Excellent. Because I am lazy. Don't get me wrong. You know, I am lazy. I don't want to do work that I can get someone else to do for me. But yeah, so the fun of the game is really, you know, you said it. It's an aquarium with Mii's. Like, you want to watch them, their behavior, what they say, and do you want to see them interact with each other? Like, people that you know, but that might not know each other. Like, my parents have never met Karen's parents. So, like, seeing my dad hang out with her mom is just weird and funny and kind of scary, you know?
And, a vision, like, almost.
What are they talking about?
Right.
Your son's a bad influence on my daughter!
No, they're talking about donuts or Virtual Boy.
Yeah, there's a lot of goofy stuff, and it's just, you know, it's all very cute. It's all very, we keep watching, like, looking at each other's games and seeing what, like, okay, now what happened? And it's just, like, we giggle, and it's just cute and funny. Like, there's one, you can see your Mii's dreams, and one of my favorites involves, like, someone being, like, kind of a fairy, being like, oh, so-and-so, the town has been invaded by flying spaghetti and only you can save us. And then so-and-so says, like, oh, by the power of coffee. And they hold up, you know, a gif of coffee. And then they turn into, like, in a very Sailor Moon-esque transformation, turn into a superhero. And
Guillaume,
then this... Yeah?
I have a serious question.
What?
Have you been using drugs?
No. But I think this is the team that made the WarioWare games.
This is a no-judging zone, but I'm worried about you.
No, this is the developers you know, and like they made WarioWare, like, you know, that they got some good stuff over there. But yeah, like, so they
they're imaginative. But I think people should know, Guillaume, that a lot of the stuff you're talking about, a lot of the events, the different locations where people might go out for a date or just to hang out, a lot of these things that might happen, they don't necessarily happen right away. I mean, you kind of have to wait for this stuff. A lot of the locations where people gather and do strange things together and you know, create these amusing anecdotes are not even unlocked when you first turn on the game. I mean, I haven't seen much of the stuff that people seem to really like about this game. And I, you know, because most of the time I've been in there, I'm either buying food, feeding food to me's, because that seems to be the only thing they really are very interested in right now, is I need more spaghetti. Or a steak or something, and just trying to like go through the menus and input people. So for me, mostly it's been busy work so far. It's been more like an actual Tamagotchi, and the really like enchanting, charming stuff that people seem to really like about this game, I think you need to stick with it and put more time into it. I really haven't seen much of it yet.
You need a certain number of Miis, and my regular play session is I open up the lid of the 3DS and the game is still running because that's all I'm playing right now. And okay, so I look who's got some demand, and then I go through all the demands, and then I, you know, I often witness like some cute stuff during that time. They'll say something funny, and then I close the lid and, you know, like, okay, see you tomorrow, game. It's kind of like a little bit the chores in Animal Crossing, but I think that the game is funnier and more charming than Animal Crossing because it's people you know. And I also think that maybe the writing's a little bit like a step above.
It's more subversive and it's...
Yeah, so I will say, as a good example, I was talking to somebody who was playing it at E3, and they had modified the lyrics of their shack opera,
right,
which you can do. And... They were showing it to me, much to my chagrin, because it's horrifying. And I observed that at the bottom, Nintendo is obviously aware this is horrifying because the button during the singing segment to make it stop is literally called
Make It Stop. Yes, it's really funny. When you
and
press
I was demanding that it be pressed.
Yeah, like when you ring it, it's just like this bell that, yeah, and like all the Miis on the stage are startled.
It's the gong show.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, there's maybe like, I don't know, like 9 or 10 musical genre that exist in the game, and they're all, you know, set songs. There's 10 songs in the game basically, and they do come with pre-made lyrics. But you can go
and
in.
They're stupid.
You can go in and edit those lyrics. So one of the first things I did was choose the musical. And I put myself and my girlfriend in it, and instead of, you know, like the happy kind of, you know, like kind of musical that it usually had, I replaced the lyrics. It's about like the Cthulhu mythos and how the old ones are going to rise up and eat us all, and that there's nothing to do but give in to despair. And that combined with like my Mii just jumping around, making these incredible dance moves, like I was just laughing my ass off.
Yeah, it was hysterical.
And it's cool to actually hear that stuff said out loud. You know, like it's really cool to write. I wish maybe you could do more of that in the game, but I think it's fairly limited to the songs. But this is your one chance to – it's very freeform. You can kind of write whatever you want, and if it gets through the filter – they'll say it.
That and catchphrases, I think.
Hey, the filter even contains like French swear words.
Oh, nice. Well, yeah, there like are obviously ways, especially because, you know, if you think about pronunciation, there are pretty easy ways to get around some of this stuff.
Sure.
Our friend Curtis Bonds has Snoop Dogg in his game, and that seems to be a really good idea based on some of the stuff he's been sharing on Twitter. But he made Snoop. He made a video, and I watched this. I thought it was pretty funny. But he got to do a song for Snoop Dogg, and he did a rap, of course. And Snoop was rapping about, let's say, a topic that Nintendo probably wouldn't approve of. He just used 3 E's instead of 2, and that got through the filter. So, and the game figured out how to pronounce that, because it's not that hard to pronounce 3 vowels in a row if they're all the same. So.
Right. I've seen Jim Sterling post a video he made about inclusivity, and it was all about popping it in his butt and it was very classy. And yeah, it got through all the fail safes. That
I think it's kind of move on. I think that's the red flag when we changed topics.
Yeah, Tomodachi's super weird. I mean, you know, James, you were asking me why would I buy Tomodachi, and I think that's a good question, especially considering I didn't really like Animal Crossing that much.
Yeah, I think especially why would you buy? Like, if exactly. It was me, I don't think you could ask why would I buy Tomodachi because I'm a terrorist.
Yeah. I mean, you would do it purely for the trolling, you know, to create awful
things. But it's
things,
also, but it's a curiosity. I mean, it is from the Wario game. Well, it is from the WarioWare guys. Like, you know that they do crazy stuff. I wanted to see that crazy stuff. And I am particularly
mushrooms
lucky.
Mushrooms, specifically. They do mushrooms.
Yeah. But I am in a situation where, like, I think I'm getting more enjoyment than I would if I were playing it by myself, because at this point I'm just adding, you know, like in jokes that I have with Karen, and it's just like the people around me, like I made my father swear in French. There's, you know, like there's this episode with my mom where we were at the cottage where there were like loons in the lake and she warbled like a loon. It was just the funniest thing. So, you know, like my mom's me on Karen's copy of the game just warbles when she's happy. And it's just, you know, that stuff it just doesn't stop cracking me up.
At some point, you probably will have seen, you know, most of the weird scenes that are built into the game. And,
right,
you know, I mean, they could be different. They'll play out differently every time because there'll be different combinations of people who are involved. But, you know, they're going to follow a certain template. And once you've seen that a few times, it may kind of run out of steam. But I mean, it doesn't surprise me you would really be into this, Guillaume. Like, this game is kind of perfect for you, I think. I mean, it's your sense of humor, and you really like funny games. And
yeah, and I did say not too long ago, like, Miis are one of my favorite things, you know, in recent years from Nintendo. So this game was made for me.
The most interesting thing they've ever done with Miis, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Smash Brothers is a really good step in that direction, too. But
I think I want to end on this. Like, my biggest fear with this game right now is that at some point I'm going to be in a conversation with an actual person that I put in my game, and I'm going to mention something about, like, the baby they had with so-and-so, or, like, something that happened in-game, and then I'm going to have to explain, oh, yes, I created a kind of version of you for this game where I'm watching you say stupid stuff. And that's going to be an extremely awkward conversation.
Yeah, just figure out an exit plan right now. Just, you know, like, hey, look, it's a, you know, it's a comet. And then, like, run away or something. You know, just figure that out, because it's going to happen.
Yep. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, the real answer to why I bought this game, I think it's two things. Number one, intellectual curiosity. What the hell even is it? Like, I felt like I had watched videos, I'd watched the Nintendo Direct, I'd talked to people, I'd asked a lot of questions about it. I still didn't really have a good grasp on what the game even is. I've played a couple hours and I still don't really know. So that's part of it. It's mysterious to me, and I want to unravel the mystery. But the other part is, it came out right before E3. And I thought, if I'm ever going to get into this game, it has to be not necessarily during E3, but it needs to be because of E3. And I spent plenty of time at E3 going through Street Pass because I wanted to collect Miis from people I knew at E3. You know, everybody on the staff, people in the media who I ran into, people from Nintendo, etc. So I've got a whole bunch of Miis now that it's going to take some work to put them in the game, but I feel like that may pay off. You know, once I have all these people I know, all these wacky characters, I feel like once I get them in there and I unlock enough of the damn features for them to actually start interacting, then that's my best chance to really enjoy the game the way it's meant to be. And so I wanted to go ahead and buy it before the show.
Yeah, I think that you do have to kind of make your own fun in this game in a certain respect, because, like, some of the most fun I've had was, like, creating that stupid musical about the end of times. And also I had a me in the game. I had a baby in the game. My G-Wizzle had a baby, and it was an ugly baby. So from then on, like, I took pictures to kind of create the story that I posted on Twitter about how this child grew unloved and uncared for and was kicked out the door eventually. And it's stupid, but that's some of the actual life. That's the kind of enjoyment you're going to get out of it.
Right. Okay. Well, let's move on from Tomodachi. I'm sure it'll come up again some other time. I'd be very curious to hear from listeners who are playing it and what they get a sense of. I feel like it'll be a divisive game. I mean, it's not for everybody. I really would not even particularly recommend it unless I knew a lot about you. You know, like this is not a game I would recommend in general. I feel like I could recommend it to specific people who I know enjoy, you know, certain things, but I don't think it's a game that I could just go out.
Well, you could
say,
also,
like, you guys got to check out this new thing on 3DS. Basically. It's awesome.
If you know about this person, like he likes The Sims or she likes Seaman or things like that, Animal Crossing, these are good indicators that you can get something out of it.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, but I don't tend to associate with such people. All right, let's move on. Let's move on and let's debrief E3 a little bit, guys. We talked about it on our respective shows last week. But we were kind of in the thick of it. We were covering, you know, game impressions and going through announcements and things like that. I wanted to take a step back and, you know, now that we've had a little bit of time to digest it, let's talk about how Nintendo did. I mean, this was a big topic before the show. We were discussing what they needed to do, what we thought they might do, and you know, what to expect. And I kind of wanted to get your guys, like, overall feeling about how did Nintendo perform? What's the buzz? Do you think it will make a difference in their situation?
I think they managed to sort of go back to their old style E3 presentations where they had a relatively easy time kind of hyping up the room, even though it's not a E3 presentation and there was no room. They historically have had a fairly capable hand at making their presentation kind of pop because they know what switches to hit to kind of get people excited.
There was some red meat in there.
And I think they did a good job of that. I think it's been a few years since they've really kind of been able to pull the right levers and sort of hit people the right way to kind of get that energy going again. So I think in that they succeeded. I think they surprised a bit in that they spent a lot of time talking to developers. I think people kind of enjoy that weren't us, people that were out there, you know, who don't go to E3. I think for them, it made the experience much more of a conversation than having somebody stand on stage and play a 5-minute demo of a game. I think it allowed Nintendo to put their message out there in a way that people who, you know, aren't sitting in an audience watching a dude play on a 170-inch screen, much more approachable. And I think the fact that they showed new IPs, multiple new IPs, it's not a fair stigma of Nintendo that they don't generate new IPs. We've talked about it on the show. It's that they generate them kind of in the eShop space.
They don't always spotlight them.
Right. I think the fact that they so openly and clearly discussed, you know, and gave, I mean, the, with the exception of Smash Brothers, the most amount of time they gave to something was Splatoon, a new IP. Mm-hmm. I think it sort of allowed them to challenge the primary narrative that floats around them. And I think ultimately they embraced humor in a way that diffused their most harsh critics. I think they were very adept at managing message and trying to control the message about what Nintendo is. And I think a big portion of that are things like the Treehouse Live, where they spent time with these games, showing them off under circumstances that we'll say are most likely ideal by having very experienced players with these games play them and talk about them, but in a way that seemed much more sincere than just having a developer talk about the 5-minute demo of the game.
Yeah, yeah. I liked the fact that it felt it wasn't entirely transparent, but it had a large air of transparency, which has been missing from pretty much anything Nintendo has done for a long time.
I would say, I mean, really, I would argue it's missing in general from E3.
I don't know
that I would say transparency, but I would say personality. You know,
what I mean by transparency is the fact that typically, if Nintendo doesn't have something that is in advanced state to show you, they won't even talk about it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They won't even talk about it until, like, it's going to be out in 3 months. But here they are talking about
back.
Yes, and they have not done that for a long time, and they seem to do it on multiple fronts this E3. They're showing stuff. They aren't really the ones to get the hype train rolling.
Yeah, I mean,
But they actually allowed themselves to do that in E3.
They didn't have the two projects and Star Fox in their video. I mean, Star Fox technically is in there, but those things are, I mean, they're barely games at this point. They're straight up tech demos, and that's a very non-Nintendo thing to do.
Yeah, I think they used to do that more, though. I mean, you guys weren't, John, maybe you remember this from the real early days, but like back in 2001, 2002, they would show stuff like Kirby Tilt and Tumble for GameCube that used the you would have to plug a Game Boy, you'd use the Game Boy Tilt cartridge in a transfer. It was fucking crazy. Mm-hmm. That never came out, you know. They used to show stuff like Talent Maker, and then they called it Talent Studio. So a lot of really weird things like that.
Yeah,
and
They showed DS Voice Chat at their booth. Remember that?
Oh yeah, which was barely used in anything, and they treat it like it was its own application that you just would be able to turn on the DS and chat with your friends around the world. And we were like, oh my God. And that never really came true.
Yeah. They would just show stuff like that for no other reason other than to just kind of get people talking about it. And it seems that they've shied away from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think their practice has been to show stuff that is in a very polished state to the point where it almost feels like it's in, you know, near release state. And that's not really what a lot of companies do during E3. So to an extent, it reflects well on them. When you play a Nintendo demo, it comes off as feeling like, wow, this thing's really close to being done. It's in really great shape.
Yeah, but even if it's not really.
Right. It's not. But on the other hand, it does mean that they don't talk about stuff as far in advance as other people. And just to a certain extent, that may be a plus. Yeah. I mean, hearing about as many 2015 games as we did is really the downer of their event. But, I mean, everybody was doing that.
It can come back and bite them, though, because then you get people just speculate.
People speculate about Nintendo anyway. I'm not sure that this...
But they have nothing to go on as opposed to maybe like a crumb. And Nintendo's given out crumbs. They kind of gave out those crumbs at E3.
I think they gave away giveaway is probably the hard term. I think they gave enough to control the narrative on every game they showed except maybe Splatoon.
Oh, yeah.
All we know is that there's more to that game than they showed. But besides that, we don't really have much to go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, they did something that I was, you know, predicting / hoping for before the show, which is, I said they need to show people that Wii U is going to thrive, or at least it's going to be sustained through the end of 2015. Like, they can't have people think that this is the last Christmas for Wii U. And I think they really succeeded. You know, and yes, I was hoping there'd be more games for this year than there are. And that is a disappointment for sure. It's a disappointment across the entire industry. But what they showed for next year is very promising. It's diverse. It's original. It's exciting. And that's exactly what they needed. I mean, no one can say, well, this is pretty much the end of the line for Wii U. I mean, you know, maybe third-party support will never come back. Maybe that system will never sell very well at all. I think it will continue to improve. It'll probably accelerate quite a bit because people are excited now. It seems like it. But, you know, I think at the very least you can feel like, hey, I've already got a Wii U. I had one since launch day. And I'm going to have stuff to play through Christmas 2015.
Right.
And six months ago, I didn't feel that good about Christmas 2015.
Yeah,
and now I'm like, you know what? It's going to be okay. You know, for me, it's going to be all right.
I don't know if, like, I don't know. I don't think Christmas 2015 is the thing that will sell Wii U's as much as Smash Brothers is. Like,
well, no,
anecdotally, I think that I've seen more people be convinced to pick up a Wii U by Mario Kart 8 than anything else, than anything seen at E3.
Sure,
and
but
I think that Smash is going to be the same way.
I think if you were on the edge saying, well, like, I'd like to have Smash Brothers, but I don't want to buy a system just for Smash Brothers, I think it takes some of the sting out of that discussion.
When you buy a system, we all know this, right? But most people don't buy a system at launch. When you buy a system at launch, there's a whole other mentality that goes into it that's mostly irrational.
Yeah.
But for most people, making, you know, a reasonable decision about buying a console gaming system, you need two things. You need games to play now, and you need to feel that there are going to be games in the future that will ultimately validate your purchase, because you figure that the game I'm buying now is probably alone not enough to justify this. But if there's a couple things I want to play now, and there's a couple things down the road, then that that tips the balance and that pushes you into buying the system.
And that's
what Nintendo needed that they haven't had up to this point. They got to have a game that you really want to play right now. They have it with Mario Kart. They're going to have it with Smash Brothers. But they also need everybody to know that, yes, stuff like Zelda and Splatoon and Yoshi are coming, and that stuff is worth being excited about.
Maybe I work backwards, but when I buy a console, I look at the game I need to play now, and I look at the back catalog, the stuff that I've been missing. I think maybe a lot of people work that way. Like, I think Mario Kart 8, people were less convinced to pick it up because, well, it's not the last game, and more because, well, I want to play Mario Kart 8 now. It's online. It's going to be fun now. And there's, like, all these games that I haven't played yet.
Are
there all these games? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean,
which games are you referring to? Another new Super Mario Brothers? Nintendo Land?
I've got four pages of stuff on my Wii U.
If that stuff was compelling, then people would have already bought the system. So, yes, those games will sell additional copies. There's also, like, used copies of those games. So that doesn't necessarily benefit Nintendo that much to say, you should go back and play those games we released 2 years ago. I don't think that is a huge influence on people's
I think the decisions. biggest victory Nintendo had coming out of this E3, not to use the who won E3 nomenclature, but personal victory, is that they managed to have a game that dominated conversation in the building, which was their Smash Brothers game, although Splatoon actually was a fairly widely talked about title as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But they also managed to have content that sort of won the narrative outside of the building.
That didn't even show up, really.
Right.
But people were still talking about it.
And through their relatively elegant use of the treehouse stuff, that was a constant conversation that was happening that people were able to engage in every single day, even after the press conferences were over. If you're not at E3, essentially E3 ends for you by the time the show floor opens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
This was a mechanism to continue to allow you to be engaged beyond the opening of the floor. And in fact, right from the floor itself.
Yeah, and this stuff's coming directly from Nintendo, so you know it's not – you know they're going to show you exclusive stuff.
Right. I mean, and they did. And I think what we saw, you know, where we were from the roundtable conversations, there was a hunger for Nintendo information that they really fed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We assisted in feeding it. I'll say that. But the
live blogs that we did from those roundtables were surprisingly very, very popular.
Yeah. Voraciously consumed.
Yes, they took us a little by surprise, and they were among, you know, the most popular things we've had on the site in a while. And part of that is, look, Nintendo did us a favor as the media by not live streaming those roundtables. I think they should have. You know, I mean, I don't think it's really useful to the consumer to show that stuff only to the media. Because
showed a lot of that stuff to the consumer the next day.
Yeah, to some extent, yes. But I mean, I think having Sakurai up there talking about his game, answering questions, that is good. That's good content that people should be able to view, and we're not allowed to take photos or videos. So,
well, they took video though. So I mean, I imagine that stuff's going to show up on their stuff at some point.
Yeah, maybe so. But, you know, I mean, the codename Steam thing was huge because nobody knew what that game was. Even if you had guessed that it would be the Steam trademark that they had filed a few weeks earlier, that doesn't tell you anything about what
that game
really is.
Yeah, you weren't guessing what that game was from that trademark. Yeah.
No one really thought that would be a strategy game. I mean, you know, maybe somebody
evoked more like a Project Hammer or something like that. I was just waiting for
Project Hammer,
bad
another
game
that Nintendo showed very early and then nothing ever happened with it.
Right.
I'm not of the mind that Nintendo should have these sort of behind closed doors things that only the media gets to see. I'm pissed that I didn't get to see Star Fox, and I know it was early, but some people got to see it and I didn't. So that pisses me off. So if I'm at home and there's this whole giant revelation of something like Steam, I'm annoyed by that. Now, luckily, they did take it to the Treehouse stage the next day, and they showed mostly the same stuff.
In fact,
stuff,
they took it to the Treehouse stage. They also took it to the GameSpot stage after the Treehouse stage. I mean, they shopped that game around afterwards.
But, the roundtable was special. It was the revelation. It was the surprise. It was, we know absolutely nothing about this. You're starting from scratch. And it was really exciting. It was like, you know, kind of overload of information on this game. And I would have preferred to share that with everybody else, you know, because we still have a role to play. We can talk about this a little bit later, but you know, I mean, there's still a good reason for us to be there in person also. But you know, I think it's kind of unfortunate that that stuff was closed off, and I don't know really the thought process that goes into that. Maybe concerned about the questions we might ask or something like that. But
I think that the idea, what they were attempting to do was to kind of sustain interest in their, you know, streaming, their Twitch streaming. I mean, I thought that they handled that whole aspect of E3 really intelligently. Like, they had the Smash Brothers tourney to really captivate people's attention, get them to visit the Nintendo Twitch stream. And after that, like, okay, people knew that this existed, and they were probably advertised like, oh, tune in tomorrow and we're going to, you know, stream some games for you. And so that was excellent, you know, to bring attention to the stream. But then they kind of ran out of new material, I think, on the Treehouse. Like, I only started watching the stream on the second day, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. They're showing some indie games, but they ended up only showing 4, and they never came back again. And that same day, like, Smash got played like 3 or 4 times. And then the next day, it was like an extended, like, hour or 2 hours of more Smash Brothers.
Well, right. I mean, they're not assuming that somebody's sitting there watching all of it. They're assuming that they're getting kind of casual.
Most normal
rotation.
People would not sit there for 23 hours and watch all of it.
During a work day,
no,
especially.
No, of course
right?
not. Of course not. But I think that the idea was, okay, well, we can't just be streaming Smash all the time. We got to... You know, we got to have something for the third day to show that's new, to bring back the people who might not be interested in watching just Smash tourneys, you know?
Well, I'm glad you brought up indie games, Guillaume, because I think that's something I want to touch upon. I spent a couple hours on the last day over in Sony's booth, and very brief, I played one Xbox game in Microsoft's booth. These were all, like, in a row in the same hall. I never even went to South Hall this year. But... you know, in Sony's booth was about, I would say, 75% taken up by indie games. And that's amazing. I mean, for a kind of game that, you know, 5 years ago wasn't at E3 whatsoever. Couldn't play a single indie game at E3 5 years ago. They existed. I mean, they were more obscure back then than they are now. But there were indie games. There have been for a long time. But you would never imagine playing one. And I remember the year that Nintendo had a WiiWare showcase, which was like one kiosk that had like 8 games on it. So, you know, people would just play Cave Story all day. And so a lot of those games you didn't even get to see. But at least they were showing these much smaller games in their E3 booth. And I thought that was one of the best things they ever did at E3. And I spent a lot of time over there checking that stuff out. And they got a lot of coverage out of our group, I can tell you, from that one demo station. Maybe there were 2. But I thought it was really a damn shame that Nintendo didn't give any credence whatsoever to indie games in their booth. Now, they
really?
Had a stage,
like, so
they had
have
a stage
those...
show, which that's good for you guys. But for me, being there in person, I didn't see any of that. I wasn't there at the stage when they did it, and they weren't in the booth at all. So I didn't get
really?
To play them. I didn't get to see them. And I think it's one of the best things happening with Wii U and 3DS right now that even a lot of people who own these platforms aren't really clued in to the quality and the number of indie games that are already out and that are coming out soon. And I think this was a really good chance because the industry is in a mode where people want to see that stuff. And people
are buying that stuff
and they're receptive to it. And Nintendo just really dropped the ball, I thought, in terms of showcase. Even Microsoft had more indie games in their booth than Nintendo did. And that's
I think the trade-off is, yes, that Sony devoted a lot of space to indie games, but they were on Vitas and they were basically sitting idle most of the show.
But that's not true. Yes, there was one row of Vita stuff.
There were 2 rows of Vita stuff.
There were many, many, many rows of PS3 and PS4 games.
I played a whole bunch of them. They needed – my biggest issue with that section of their booth was how tight it felt. Like it was just all kind of mashed together. It was hard for stuff to stand out.
Maybe they could have been more selective.
Yeah, I think that's the tricky part is figuring out which games you want to show and that kind of stuff. Nintendo should have done a better job of it. Nintendo itself didn't I don't want to say they didn't have a lot of kiosks. They did, but they didn't have a lot of kiosks that weren't Smash Brothers.
Right. Oh, and it was a long wait to play Hyrule Warriors and some of the other games.
Yeah, I mean, I think they had two Bayonetta 2s and one Bayonetta. They had...
Yeah.
Yeah, and do you really need a kiosk for Bayonetta 1?
I mean, no, not you don't.
It's a freebie.
It's, it was I, a, yeah.
I mean,
was
I'm glad
weird,
they're doing that, but I don't think that
it
needs
was
to have a demo
weird utilization of their booth space. And I understand why Smash Brothers had a lot of booths, but ultimately that thing was burning through four players every 4 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, you never had to wait long to play Smash Bros. And there was also like huge swath of the booth that was just empty space for. I guess they thought people would crowd around and watch the big projection of Smash.
Yeah, I don't know.
On the wall, but that I never really saw.
I don't think it's so much that they didn't want to show indie games. I think it's that they laid out their booth badly.
It was a bad layout. I thought.
I mean, I like that it's open. I like that there's space to move in it. That's sort of the biggest.
Well, until there's not. I mean, half the booth is one game.
Right.
And the other half of the booth is 15 other games. And if you want to play any of those 15 other games, it's super crowded and it takes forever.
Yes.
And it's really hard to get through. So I don't think that's a real good setup. I mean, these are like
no, I don't
very
think it was either.
Specific
I mean,
E3 attendee problems.
I would say a quarter of their booth ended up being – was also that corner they had cut off for Splatoon.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I think – I don't necessarily know that they didn't want to show them. I think it's that they had prioritized showing these games in this format, and I think that's ultimately the biggest problem they ran into.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, booth layout aside, that's so esoteric that, you know, no one's really going to be sympathetic to that.
No, and it's their own doing. I'm not suggesting being sympathetic.
My point being, they had room to show indie games on the floor. They could have put indie games in the digital event, and they didn't. I mean, they could have, you know, that digital event was 45 minutes, and I know people like how brisk it was. Could have been 55 minutes, and they could have spent 10 minutes showing a bunch of indie games, and they didn't. They released a shitload of trailers the day before, but that was the same day that Microsoft and Sony and Ubisoft and EA all did their press conferences. So how many people saw those eShop trailers? Not many, you know? Not a real good day to do that. So I just feel like, in general, they could have handled that a lot better, because it's, I mean, those games are coming. And some of them will be great. I mean, it is an asset that they already have that they didn't really take the opportunity to tell people about it, I felt. And I think that was one of the very few mistakes they made, because I really felt like Nintendo did a smash-up job this year. And frankly, just to go back a little bit to last year, when I actually caught some flack for being critical of Nintendo's presence at E3 last year, is anyone going to argue with me that in comparison, last year was horrible to this? They
yeah,
did
last
so
year
much
terrible.
Better this year.
I mean,
there are multiple reasons why I stayed home this year, and that's one of them.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, last year was a fucking bad E3 for Nintendo, like real bad.
I
went on Weekend Confirmed and said that. And Garnet's like, "How can you say that? They had Mario Kart," and I'm like, "Barely, you know, really."
Yeah. I did 20 hours of home team work in 2 days, and I don't remember a fucking thing from last year's E3.
It was really dull. And it's not that they were showing bad games, but they weren't highlighting the good stuff that they had, and they weren't showing nearly enough for considering how poorly their system was doing at the time. They didn't look like they really cared that much last year.
Yeah.
This year was so much more aggressive and thoughtful and inspired.
Yeah,
and
there was no buzz or no energy around them last year. Their stream was broken. It was just dumb. It was just so bad.
It was very poorly done, and I mean, I got to give them a lot of credit. They obviously turned the ship around, in terms of E3 at least. They turned the ship around. The buzz has been very, very strong for them, and, you know, like, it's very hard to say how well does E3 buzz turn into, like, sales. You know, that's a pretty tough formulation, but I think it certainly isn't bad for them.
It makes them
it can only
alive.
Be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes it look like they're fighting, you know, like they really care, and they're making things that people are excited about, and that's what you have to do to sell systems.
Yeah, I mean, people are talking about Nintendo again.
Especially in the vacuum of third-party support.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I mean, last year they looked dead in the water. Nobody was talking about them. They weren't showing anything interesting. It was just, all right, Nintendo, they're still around. Let's just move on. And coming out of this E3, completely different. I mean,
yeah, I'm barely aware of what happened to Sony and Microsoft this E3.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, they what they came out with was exactly what you would expect. They had some good games in there, but it's kind of like, first person shooter, check. You know, Dark Souls type game, check. They just checked all the check boxes. Racing game, sure. Metal Gear game, sure. Nintendo, they actually showed a lot of stuff that people didn't expect that was interesting. I mean, it was just they got people talking again.
Yep. I think
that's definitely one of the things they needed to do really
and
bad.
And, you know, we say this, and kind of my last thought on it. I think the biggest thing they did was that they had color. I mean, it seems so blasé, but God, that was a colorful presentation. And it really stood out.
And their games are colorful.
They are. You know, they are. And it really stood out after. I mean, we watched almost all of the Monday stuff, and it really stood out even more than usual.
Yeah, I mean, they really set themselves apart as a company. Everything from the way their games played, the way their games looked, the types of games that they were giving to people.
The kinds of really characters set them apart. Their games.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't. It certainly was not a Me Too E3 for Nintendo.
And it was basically like the only. They were the only ones to actually show gameplay, to actually explain the gameplay.
Yeah, I think having the developers talk as opposed to just showing somebody playing the game is a revelation.
Mm-hmm. Right, well, and like when they would show people playing games at the other conferences, you knew it was all staged, it was all prepared. Whereas here, like the on, you know, like in the Nintendo Direct, like you had the footage, and they had the developers explain, okay, this is where we came from, and this is what the game is about. And then during the Treehouse streaming, you just had a bunch of guys who could actually talk about the games intelligently, and also they were playing and having fun with it.
That Yoshi Woolly World intro video was charming as hell.
Right, like
in the yarn shop.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
They had a little doll.
I mean, Tezuka has an infectious personality as it is. Even if you don't understand what he's saying, he makes you smile.
Yeah, and when you see him in person, you will grin.
Yeah, and
I mean, he's just... He has that effect on people.
And they really played it up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, the stuff Nintendo did at E3 this year, the things that they are doing now, the things that they have to show... to me, are not drastically different than they've had in years past. They just showed it better. It's all about E3 is it's all about presentation. It's about how you carry yourself. It's about your attitude, and it's about highlighting the things that you do best. And I thought they did an awful job of that last year, and not very good the year before that either. This year, they really, like, you got the sense that, yes, these are the things I love about Nintendo, and they're actually at E3 this year. It's so nice.
I for once, feel like I was having fun the whole time I was on the show floor.
Yes, me too.
And that's
and
that's
I barely
so
left Nintendo's booth, and I was still having a good time.
I know. It sounds like entitled media problems, but E3 can really feel like a slog. But I had fun the entire time I was on the floor this year.
Yeah, and I think it's very meaningful. And again, this might be very specific to people who go to E3, but I mean, they do drive a lot of the message and the buzz and the conversation that happens afterward. But I think it means a lot that Nintendo's games were, you know, the games in their booth are playable. There was no lining up to go sit in a theater and watch someone else play the game for you, or just to go watch a CG movie. Even the big screen, a lot of companies have this like really big screen in their booth where they show trailers and shit. Well, in Nintendo's booth, it's a screen of people playing live Smash Bros.
Right. And you can
get in line and do and be part of that, you know? It's like it felt more interactive, which is what video games are all about. Like, imagine that you go to a company's booth at E3 and actually get to play their games. Like, that is not the case for so many companies. And Nintendo really did a fantastic job of that. And it, you know, I think it did them a lot of good. Because that, it does, I mean, it doesn't mean that much to people at home, right? But it means a lot to the people who are there. And those people leave the show and they're still talking and they're still processing the memories of actually playing these games. And that is very meaningful.
Right.
And if they can then convey that to people at home who didn't get to be there. Of course, Nintendo also does a nice job of letting people actually play their E3 demos if you live within the right Best Buy and can stand in line for a while. It's kind of a shitty way of doing it, but at least it's something. It's more than the other guys do. So, you know, for Nintendo, they really treat E3 as a place where you should play video games. And that is not typical.
No.
And I really appreciate it. I think it sets them apart. It's yet another way.
Well, they focused on entertaining rather than informing, promoting, publicizing, which is what Microsoft
and
Sony
and
did.
I'll tell you, we were watching – we weren't the only ones watching it, by the way. We were watching the Nintendo digital event in the media room, and
right.
people were having fun watching it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, you could hear people laughing, and you know, you looked around, people were smiling as they're – and they're watching it for the first time just like anybody at home. But it was nice to see that, yeah, I mean, this stuff is appealing to the professionals as well. The people who are there to work are excited about what Nintendo's doing. And that, you know, I think that does them some good as well.
Yeah, there was kind of a, I don't know, I just so enjoyed the contrast with the you know, the stuff that the others were doing, where fun didn't really seem part of it. You know, like not just in the way that it presented it, but
I think the games seemed to focus.
I think that's kind of harsh.
There were games that were all about fun.
And maybe it's not your kind of fun, but it is fun. I mean, stuff's fun to me.
I mean, I thought Microsoft and Sony both did a good job.
I think the word you're looking for is playfulness.
Like, what comes to my mind is like the Division trailer that was shown at Sony's presentation. Like, that
Man,
thing was
that
designed
to
make people shit in their pants. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. But, like, the trailer was made to make you feel like shit, you know? Like, what the hell? What was that about?
Yeah, that game is not appealing to me at all. But, I mean, Sony showed stuff like Little Big Planet. Microsoft showed stuff like Sunset Overdrive. And those were people's favorite parts of those press conferences, you know, because it felt like a breath of fresh air. For Nintendo, that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Their whole presentation is like that. And I think this year in particular, they're getting credit for it in a way that they haven't other years. And maybe part of that is how they've carried themselves and how they pushed it this year. And maybe part of it is just that's the culture, you know, like people in gaming are thinking about these things. People are getting really tired of seeing the same stuff over and over again, and especially in the media. And you know, I think it might have been right place, right time as well, but it seemed to work out really well for them. And there is more that we could talk about. We do have some emails about Nintendo's presence at E3 that I really want to get into. It's going to have to wait until next week. But here's my promise. We're going to do an extra large chunk of mail next week. We'll let it bleed over into the first segment if we have to, because there are a lot of really good ones that I want to catch up on. Unfortunately, we didn't have time this week. There's one email that's short, and I think we'll be able to disposition it very quickly, but it's timely. It's relevant this week, and it may not be relevant next week. Who knows? So I want to get to that one right now. And John, maybe you could read this this email from Diet Cake.
Okay. Diet Cake writes, "Recent news has come up that Capcom is now up for sale. Their shareholders decided to quit their takeover defense strategy and are selling 50% of their shares. Whoever buys them will take over Capcom. While it's sad to see Capcom continue to struggle, I think that if Nintendo buys Capcom, the future will be bright for both of them. What are the possible benefits for Nintendo and Capcom through this, and what are the potential issues with it?"
So
sounds like a big, wide-open discussion question, but it's really not, and James is going to tell you why.
So
yeah.
Half that news is correct. Capcom did vote to end their takeover defense strategy. I haven't seen
Well, their shareholders voted.
Yeah, their shareholders, right.
Yeah.
I haven't seen any indication that they are intending to sell 50% of the company stock. I've seen conversation about how much that would cost, but that I haven't seen that particular piece of news. So essentially what's happened is since 2008, Capcom has had a standing marching orders in the event another company or individual came along and said, "I would like to purchase 50% plus one share of Capcom," which would make them the controlling interest in the company. And that it's basically just a series of steps they would do in order to either prevent it from happening or make it so costly that no one would attempt it, or to dilute the ability of the individual and or company to perform that action.
And it's known as a poison pill policy, meaning that break glass in case of emergency.
Let's just talk about what this really means. The new decision, I mean, they did change something. What does that really mean?
Are they up for sale or not? Essentially, Capcom's board had a vote this week that said, do we want to continue our current strategy of takeover defense? And I don't know what the formulation of their takeover defense strategy is. I'm sure it's available. If I could read Japanese, I could go dig it up. But at the moment, I don't have it in front of me. And essentially, the board voted no. They don't want to continue the current strategy. That doesn't necessarily mean that they don't want to have a strategy. It just simply means they rejected the strategy that's currently on the books.
Yeah.
So now, what that means
now, perhaps it wasn't in the shareholders' best interest. Maybe they didn't like it. Whatever.
Right. I mean, they could be voting to move. I mean, ultimately, this could be more of a statement of we would like to change strategies from maybe a poison pill to one where the shareholders get to buy a bunch of stock dirt cheap in the event of a takeover attempt. I mean, they could be trying to move to something that's more favorable to them. And it may be that they are just simply they don't want to go through the expense and haggle of or having a takeover defense in play because there is some cost associated with that. Maybe they don't feel like there's a high risk of takeover. And it may well be a vote of no confidence in the current company's executive board. And this is one way of them kind of saying, hey, we're not happy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that Capcom is for sale, as some sites have reported erroneously. And it's a statement that you could, in theory, now buy the company in a way that wouldn't destroy you economically or burden you with having to pay off a bunch of executives. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a good idea, and it doesn't mean that it's going to happen. There are companies that exist in the vacuum without takeover defenses in place.
Yep.
Now
it's just a change in policy. It's like saying, "Hey kids, if the house catches on fire, hop out, go out the front door."
Right.
Okay, that's probably not a good idea. Maybe we should use the window instead.
Yeah. Now the policy is we'll figure it out when there's a fire.
Exactly.
So Capcom. Mm-hmm.
So they may be open to the possibility, but maybe it depends on who comes knocking.
Right. This isn't.
So maybe they want to keep options open. So you know, if Microsoft comes and tries to buy Capcom. They may not like that, and they say, "No, we're gonna find a way to prevent that." But if another company comes along and wants to do it, well, maybe let's talk.
And right,
let's see what the terms
this
are.
This doesn't takeover defenses never preclude mergers and acquisitions. They exist for the idea of the hostile acquisition, which is somebody basically without consulting the company going through to individual investors and trying to accrue the requisite number of stock to become the controlling investor.
So it'd be like James buying Sony.
Right. It would be like me buying a bankrupt company. Yes. But I have a house. And they don't have a – they sold their office. So it'd be fair. This is a defense against somebody coming from the outside without engaging the board and saying, hey, we'd like to acquire your company. Let's negotiate a resolution to it.
Yeah, and so I mean, in the event of a hostile takeover, I mean, it wouldn't preclude them from defending themselves anyways.
Right.
It's just they don't have a preset way to do it right now.
Right. They could figure something out as they went. Now, it would
the point being, look, let's get to the nitty-gritty here. Nintendo could buy Capcom, maybe, if they wanted to. Maybe.
They always could have.
But
right.
Maybe they could have before this. This doesn't necessarily change whether that's likely, whether that's possible, whether it's allowed, whether Nintendo has any interest whatsoever. They probably don't. Nintendo's not really into buying big companies. They haven't even bought small companies lately.
It would be a waste anyways.
Maybe another company does. You know, I mean, you've seen Square and Enix merge. You've seen Namco and Bandai merge. I mean, maybe that is the future for Capcom, but it's not necessarily directly related to this news. And the idea, and the reason I wanted to get this out there is because I know there's a lot of misinformation, and James obviously knows a lot about this, maybe too much. But this news has been widely misreported. And it's really not true that Capcom is up for sale. And it's especially not true that – or it's not necessarily true that Capcom is interested in being sold to another company or that a whole bunch of other companies, Nintendo included, are interested and are imminently about to try to do this.
Right.
So I just don't want people to like run off into fantasy land. Not saying it can't happen, but it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. And this really doesn't mean what a lot of people have taken it to mean. That's why I wanted to get to this before the end of the show. But we do need to wrap it up, guys. So we appreciate that email. We have quite a backlog of emails, and there are some really great ones that I want to get on the show next week. But you can make it even harder for us to choose which ones to read by sending an email to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Feel free to ask about anything we've covered on the show, anything we haven't covered that you want to talk about. Don't ask us about competitive Smash Brothers. We're so done talking about that on the show. Sorry. But there's lots of other topics that we could get into. So again, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and we look forward to hearing from you. And that's it. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. Thank you to these guys for talking to me for a couple hours every week. And we'll see you next time.
Bye. Later.
Bye.